Amen. cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Sadhu, sadhu,
Dear Ajahn, this is a comment, easy one. I like your haircut. Yes, we spent a lot of money on this, you can tell. Santuti did it for me, if you're wondering.
Yeah, the barber shop opens tomorrow morning. Everybody wants that.
A night after the Q&A, around 9:15 p.m., most of us are sleepy and tired and difficult to concentrate well. Ooh, must be the second half of a question. Okay, there you go. Dear Ajahn, thank you very much for the brilliant teachings. We can get the maximum benefit out of your teachings if you could please give the Dhamma talk in the morning before or after the one-half guided meditation, because our minds are fresh in the morning and easy to absorb all the talk. A night after the Q&A around 9:15, most of us are sleepy and tired and difficult to concentrate well. Okay. Good question. We can do that. Let me think. Yeah, we can do because what, it's 8 to 9. We have a stretch of about 2 hours. After the before the meal, yes, yeah, so maybe after meditation, stretch your leg a little bit, and then the Dhamma talk. Yeah, okay, we can do that. It's true, because sometimes there's a lot of questions. It's true. By the time we finish, it's around 9:15 or 9-ish, and then I have to squeeze in my quick Dhamma talk, and then yeah, it might be. Excuse me. From 8 to 9 is still the guided meditation.
Yeah, in the evening.
Oh, and even this the Q&A, I don't add my, you know, last 15 minutes of Dhamma talk. Yeah. Okay, yeah, that sounds good. I can do that tomorrow. Okay, for those who are interested. Dear Ajahn, what is the procedure for becoming a monk? Are there always places available? Is it possible to try it out for a couple of years? That's right. Would you recommend doing a ranged retreat first to get an idea of the lifestyle? Thanks. Yeah, I think with Bodhinyana as well, the same with what Buddhadhamma. What happens is you come and stay in the monastery for a month first. You check the monastery out. We check you out. After that, if you're happy, you call the ast for the going forth. So in each stage of the procedure is the applicant to ask to go forth. Yeah. So then if you want to become a monk, there's a year training dressed in white. You might see the lady in white there. It's the same with the nuns, I think. And other people will come in dressed in white. Yeah. Shave your head, get a nice haircut, dressed in white for a year. Then after that, you still want to become a monk. You become a novice for another year, dressed in the same clothes, but there's another piece of rope that you don't have yet. But you're in training. A novice monk in training for a year. Then after a year of being a novice, then if you still want to go forward, you ask again for the ordination, and then the community will decide yes or no or whatever. Yeah. So it's about a 2 years process. At any stage of the time, you can don't have to go forward. You can stay where you are. And yeah, so it's a process that is initiated by the person who wants to become a monk and not the monastery. But unfortunately, Bodhinyana is very full. I understand there's a long waiting list. Sacha Brahm is a very well-known teacher. Yeah. But Awa Buddhadhamma, and there's no list. Because Ajahn Kamvara is not very well-known. That's right, that's right. After this retreat. And so that is, and you can try it out at any stage, like you say, try it out for being a couple of years or not. In the Theravada tradition, there's no kind of shame or embarrassment if you change your mind at any stage of the process. Even once you become a monk, generally you commit to staying in the monastery and train for 5 years, but there's many people who change their mind. And it's no problem. You can change your mind, go back and forth, I don't know, 6 or 7 times. It's no problem. We have a few monks who do that. Yeah, because it's nothing is really lost. You learn, you know, to live in a community as a monk, and things change. And then you go out, you can still practice as a lay person. Yeah, and you find out sometimes your practice, you know, it's more focused being a monk. Yeah, you go to a monastery. You can do a ranged retreat. Lay people can do a 3-month ranged retreat as well at Bodhinyana and at Wat Buddhadhamma. And so that is also a good feel. So we always recommend people who are kind of mildly interested, just come to your monastery and stay for a couple of weeks first and see how that goes. Yeah. Some people, yeah, you know, we get a few applicants who are very idealistic. They can read a good book. They have a good retreat. They get really excited and it's like, oh, yeah, you know, I've sold everything, divorced my wife. Now I want to become a monk forever. And then they go to a monastery and they're like, oh, I don't like this. I don't like you guys. I don't like the monastery. Too many rules. I'm going to leave now. Yeah. So that's why I say we always suggest, you know, just, you know, kind of stay there first and see what happens. Yeah. Any questions or comments? Dear Ajahn, you mentioned earlier that the mind is inclined towards negativity, for example, complaints about the noise from doors, etc. Have you heard of the saying, did the noise disturb you, or did you disturb the noise? Can you please explain further on this? Thank you, with metta. Yes, this quote came from a very well-known teaching by Ajahn Chah. The antidote goes that Ajahn Chah was meditating late one night, and in Thailand, back then, and still happens, that the Thais, you know, like to party and like to share it with everybody. So they have these big loudspeakers outside, so everybody in the neighborhood can hear the party happening. There's no noise control, and of course, the monastery is not very far from the village, so you hear this party a couple of times in, you know, a week, pretty much. And that would annoy the monks, you know, also annoyed Ajahn Chah. But then when his meditation was really deep, he found that he obviously can focus so deeply into his breath that he didn't notice the noise. Or the noise was there, but then the mind didn't go out. And the same, so one of his famous teachings is that, you hear the noise, but it's only a split second. It's the narrative, it's the complaining after the noise, sitting there thinking, why does this happen? Why don't they be quiet? Why don't they leave me alone? Why don't they be more mindful or whatever? That is more of this disturbing bit. And it's the same. You think about it logically. Sometimes it's logic, and you try to reflect that way. It helps you kind of focus inward and not to be caught up by the outside disturbances. The noise, you know, like I said, you know, coughing, someone shutting the door, walking loudly, or whatever, or someone say something to you, a criticism. The interaction is only a few seconds. It's what happens after that. We keep remembering, we keep going back to it, we keep, you know, arguing with it. And it can go for, you know, hours, days, and months even, when we don't like something. Yeah. So that bit is the bit that we add on to the experience. Someone may say something mean to us, okay, that's their karma, but that's very small. But we're making bad karma by just remembering, rehashing it, adding up on top of that. And that's something that is completely optional. We don't have to do that. That's the bit of suffering that we add on to ourselves. The other person may be a trigger, but you know, they're not really the cause of our suffering. So much of our suffering is internal. Yeah, something that we add on, something we do to ourselves. So knowing that, you know, you have strong mindfulness, you keep reflecting on this, yeah. You know, who is disturbing whom? Noise disturbing us, or we go out to disturb the noise by searching around, looking for it, remembering, hold on to it, reacting to it. Yeah. So that's one of Ajahn Chah's famous teaching. Every time you hear a noise, you know, just remember who is disturbing whom. Yeah. Questions or comments? Okay. Moving on. Dear Ajahn, if craving to be, for example, wanting to attain enlightenment, jhana, and craving not to be, do not want to be reborn, are going to obstruct one's meditation, how does one let go of the craving? Second question, what is the difference between this kind of craving and adhidhana, wanting to realize nibbana in this very life? Usually chant at the end of each retreat day in the Burmese tradition. Thank you. And that's the thing. There are different types of craving or different aspiration. And it depends on how we hold on to that. Yes, you know, it's fine to have this aspiration to attain enlightenment in this very life or to attain a deep meditation absorption states like the jhana. But that's the aspiration that puts you into the retreat, the organizing, the taking the leave, you know, organizing your household life so that you're here for 9 days. And that's where wisdom should arise in the sense that, you know, that, and that's where you should stop aspiration to get you here. But if you carry that aspiration into your sitting and wanting to get things, wanting to move on, wanting to get rid of things, you know, from personal experience, you'll see those aspirations, you carry them onto your meditation, will be a big source of disturbance because you're never in the present moment. You're always looking for something else, looking ahead to what you can achieve, looking ahead to what you can get rid of. And those are the aspirations will also be a major, you know, stumbling block to any peace of mind. Yes, it's good to have aspiration, but it's good to know when to let them go as well. I want to just leave them at the door. You know, many teachers will say, yeah, okay, leave all your, you know, kind of aspirations at the door, outside the door when you go into the meditation hall. And, you know, what you think it should be or shouldn't be, where you want things to be or not be. You know. And then when you come here, you know, like I said, you know, every session is a different session. Every session is new. It's different. Yeah, so not having the kind of preconceived notions of how far you get or how far you won't get, how bad or good the session might be. You know, most of you see a lot of familiar faces, you've been meditating long enough to know, yeah, it's always slightly different. It's never the same. And never what you expect. Yeah, if you're expecting, you're not looking. You're looking somewhere else. You're not staying in the present moment. And that would be a source of disturbance always in the meditation. Yeah, so it's fine to have aspirations, but to remember, you know, when is it appropriate to allow things to be, to make peace in the present moment. Yeah. So same with one of the qualities that Buddha also taught was called aditana, which is kind of the asserting of the truth. Like, you know, some people, to help them, you know, kind of practice, they say, you know, may I be enlightened this very life or something. It's fine to have those things. Or, you know, may I sit? You know, I'm going to sit for make a determination to not lie down tonight. And with those aspirations, it helps to kind of focus the mind, give it energy. But use it wisely. You don't. A lot of time we do these kind of aspirations out of craving, wanting things. You know, we read, and it's very inspiring. You know, the Buddha made an aspiration. I will not rise from this posture. May my body rot, my bones dried up, my blood dried up. I will not rise from this posture until I achieve enlightenment. But then again, he was the Buddha, right? So he's had a few things going for him. And we read it, we do the same thing, and yeah, you know, about 20 minutes later, we get a sore knee, we get up. Yeah. So you break too many of those aspirations, it starts to undermine the next time. So make aspiration, but make little ones first. Some things that we can keep. Yeah. Something that we can hold on to, something that we can attain. Yeah, so it's just kind of trying to stretch your kind of areas of comfort, your comfort zone a little bit. But don't overreach, because then that would be, you know, cause disappointment, discouragement to the path. Yeah, so it's good to have these kind of aspirations, but make them realistic and hold them lightly. And yeah, and don't be afraid if you can't make it. Yeah, just, you know, learn from that. Yeah. Okay, any questions or comments regarding aspirations and when and meditation? Yeah. Okay. Dear Arjan, if sati involves knowing, i.e. breathing in, I know that I'm breathing in, what happens, if anything, to this knowing during samadhi? Does it change, drop away? Thank you. No, this knowing becomes more clear during samadhi. So what you know is the object of meditation, the bliss or the different things that changes. So you're aware. But sometimes people in very deep meditation, because they're focused so, you know, the mind is so absorbed into the breath or the light or the feeling of bliss and rapture, that's the only thing they're aware of, the kind of the rapture and the happiness at the moment. And things like noise outside, sensation of the body, they're not aware of any of that. So my themes, you know, sometimes so in the beginning, some of the people translate these absorption states as states of, what do they call that, where you, what's the word, when they go into like comatose kind of thing, that they're not aware of anything, and that's not true. Yeah, so there is kind of heightened awareness, but it's very single pointiness onto the meditation object, let's say the breath. Yeah, so there's knowing very clearly, but that knowing is not the normal knowing where it floats around the body and it floats around the sounds and hearing and all that. You're in kind of a deep absorption state. There's no hearing, no body, and no thinking. So the telltale signs that you're not in it, you can say, wow, this is really good. I'm finally getting somewhere. That's not a jhana. Wait until I tell my friend about it. That's not a jhana. My leg hurts. That's not a jhana. Yeah, so those are telltale signs to know when you're not. Usually you don't know really if you're in a jhana until afterwards, when the mind starts to expand and you know, goes back to normal and it feels the body again. Yeah. So, yeah. So, and with anything, is not to get too caught up in the different kind of mental states. Just allow the mind just kind of, you know, to be in the present moment, to open up, to focus on the meditation object. And when you get to a certain point, it's kind of a automatic process, and you're not really there. The more you're there, kind of manipulate, change things, the more you disturb the process. So after when the mind gets close enough, it kind of does its own thing, and you're just staying there. You're just the watcher. Yeah. So try to cultivate the watcher more than the doer. Questions or comments? That's the thing with this mental state. It's kind of hard to describe because we describe certain words in the physical world. But in the mental world, it's a bit hard. That's why you see so many different descriptions in different books, and it sounds contradictory. But maybe the experience is kind of weird, so that's why. It feels like an open up, but then, you can also look at it another way. It's like a really focusing into a one pointed, one object. Yeah. Yeah. But it feels like sort of opening up as well. Yeah, so that's why you see that there's this experience and there's kind of the description of it, and people describe it differently based on their own kind of conditioning and how they look at it. Depends what they look at. Yeah. Questions or comments? Oh, yeah, so I'm supposed to repeat the questions. I'll do that next question. Dear Ajahn, a comment only. Your guided metta meditation this morning was excellent. Although maybe unrelated, today I managed to sit pain-free for the whole day. In the afternoon, I struggled to have present moment awareness. In the end, I succeeded and managed to establish a beautiful mindfulness, which I used to observe the breath effortlessly for 10 to 15 minutes. Okay, now very good. I guarantee you, the pain will come back. But enjoy it when it happens. And that's the thing with the pain. Yeah, you know, we all have pain. But it's not a big deal. It's just pain. Just like, you know, as long as you get up and, you know, a bit of stretching, a bit of walking around is fine again. It's not a big deal with anything. You know, and it's a great way just to learn to live with it. Because as we get older, different things come upon the body. And then, you know, it's not always comfortable. When you're young, energetic, it's great. But as you get older, and this room is about, you know, the second phase of life, second half. Yeah, that only increases. Yeah, but it's great to learn to live with it, to learn to be at peace with it. To learn, you know, to see it as a friend, or certainly not as a threatened being, because it's part of life. So not trying to shut, you know, it out, trying to dismiss it, run away from it. Dear Ajahn, how do we make sense of the bad things happening to what seems like good people, especially innocent children? Is the karma from past life the reason? No. I mean, sometimes when you see that traditional Buddhists say that, and that's very close to blaming the victim, what doesn't really make sense or seem very compassionate thing to do. The karma of sickness and injustice, war and violence, it's just a reminder, this is what happens when you get born into the human realm. This is the human realm. There's, you know, a fair share of beauty and love and generosity and sharing. But also there's a fair share of the negative stuff. And yeah, you know, we don't escape from that. So the Buddhist response when you meet with, you know, what appears to be kind of injustice or a lot of suffering, you know, irrational suffering or unfair suffering in the world, is to help where you can. You know, it's no point asking the kid, you know, who has cancer or whatever, or who is an orphan, you know, what bad things you do in the last life to deserve this. It's like, well, it doesn't matter, right? We help where we can. And karma is a very complicated thing, really. Only the Buddha knows. And it's also, just because of what appears to be bad karma, you know, born into a poor family, or you know, born with a disease or something, it depends on how you relate to it, what you make of it. Because we see the opposite, people born into, you know, wealthy family, healthy, happy, and then they waste it by doing silly things, getting drunk all the time or using their wealth and power to kind of oppress other people. Yeah. So, you know, it's not so clear, you know, if you are suffering, that it's something bad or you're doing something right. You know, whatever happening in the situation, we can always learn from it. We can always rise. We always, you know, make a good thing out of it. Famous story, I heard that, you know, Ajahn Brahm tells about, you know, karma. Karma is like, you know, this, the story is like the like baking a cake, right? It's two lady. One lady who has, you know, the latest equipment from, what's the story? David Myers or something? Best oven, organic ingredients, organic apple and brown sugar, harnessed from, you know, the best farm. Not a trace of kind of toxin anywhere for miles and miles. And it's just, you know, all the time in the world, this modern kitchen, beautiful, great, the best recipe book. And they have another lady who, you know, doesn't have a really kitchen. It's kind of a makeshift kitchen with a bit of stove, pot, a few rotten apple, just white plain sugar, which is full of crusty coffee because people stick wet spoons in it. Not a proper oven. But, you know, who makes a better pie? Who makes a better pie? You don't know. If this lady who, you know, cuts away the rotten apple and just uses the good bits, she works with, you know, she's very mindful, puts all the love and attention to baking the apple pie. The other lady is too busy watching TV, doing her hair. She's busy. She got the places to go to. You know, who makes a better cake, a pie? It's not sure. Same with karma. We're dealt with a certain things, and it depends what we make of it that determines the outcome of our life. Yeah. So it's not like the whole story saying, you know, so and so is born poor or with a disease. You know, lots of people have disease, life-threatening disease, cancer, AIDS, but it breaks them up. They live moment by moment better than a person who is healthy and then, you know, throws it away by, you know, taking drugs and doing silly things and harming others, not caring for their family around them. And then they die, you know, kind of mindless. Yeah? So it doesn't really matter. It's not so important, really, what you're given. It's what you do with it that's so much more important. Yeah? And that's the teaching of the Buddha. It's always encouraged, teaching Ajahn Chah. You know, karma, you know, born with, you know, some kind of a defect, born in a poor family. It's not the whole story. It doesn't determine how you end up, what you do with your life. Yeah? Questions or comments? Yes.
Right. I would have laughed at you and I would have scoffed at you with science and I would have told you how long you were. Chopped the leg off, happy as Larry, and again. So it's clearly complicated.
Right. It's not straightforward. And, no, it's good. And it's good that it brought you to the, you know, the monastery. Yeah, sure. Dear Ajahn, in what situations one has to use skillfulness in meditation practice? skillfulness, I think, is the word we use, you know, to apply the different skills that you know and learn to the situation, to, you know, kind of improve the meditation, to see what works. Yeah, so it's not like a fixed idea of, you know, this is what you do all the time. It's like, you know, every time you sit down, you know, kind of check in. You know, how's the body? How's the mind? You know, what might work today? You know, it's the breath. You watch the breath, and it, you know, seems to not go anywhere. Okay, then it's time to kind of shift tactics. Instead of just banging your head away, you know, banging at the breath, banging the breath, and not getting anywhere, and getting annoyed, and you're disappointed. Yeah. So it's always trying to encourage people to approach the practice more like, yeah, like intuitively, like it's an art. Always kind of, you know, don't be afraid to experiment, to say what works or not. There's the usual meditation method of, you know, breathing, metta, walking, and body. But there are other ways to approach it. Many ways to watch the breath. You know, it's at the tip of the nose, you know, on the upper lip, your chest, you know, or wherever it is that is the clearest. It could be in your hands, you feel the breathing there, or just watch different things. So in any of these kind of method, you know, kind of really play with it, own it, make it your own somehow. And then you'll find that your meditation will become more fun, more interesting, and deeper at the same time. Yeah, just kind of plug away, watch in breath, out breath. It doesn't work. These Buddhists don't know what they're talking about. Yeah, so it's not so much the method, it's like how we approach it. Yeah, what you do with it. The next couple of days, Ajahn Tantuti will give you his version of the metta meditation. You'll see how that works. We can have a guided meditation face-off. Dear Ajahn, can you please explain the meaning of sadhu? I think that's the word that is said three times, often after a session with love. Yes, sadhu is the Buddhist way of saying well said, well said, well said. Oh, well done. You see someone doing something really well, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. So you see people offering the food, so that's what they say, sadhu to you, sadhu, sadhu. Yeah, so it's kind of an expression of appreciation of something well done, well said, well presented. Yeah. Any other questions or comments? Dear Ajahn, we are supposed to breathe normally in meditation. Can I take a longer breath? As I find that it's easier to focus. How long should you try to meditate before you give up if you're not focused or restless? Yes. That's a very personal question. Yes, it's not a problem. Generally, you do try to, you know, leave the breath alone and just watch it. But occasionally, if you're feeling a bit tired, deep breath, and then slowly exhale as well. You find yourself thinking a lot, stop, take a deep breath, exhale also helps. Like in Cha's famous kind of advice, that if you find yourself, you know, hard to keep the breath on, stop breathing. I'll come back to you. The mind will go too far if you're not breathing. You'll come back in a couple of minutes. Yeah, so anything that, you know, kind of help with the focus. And it's true, you know, like I said, we give you these instructions, but try different ways to see what helps, and not to kind of just to approach it kind of, you know, in a way that's just kind of just banging away without really thinking or evaluating. So after each session, always evaluate, you know, did that work? How's it working? Did I take the right kind of antidote? It's always a bit of tweaking, turning, just a little bit, not too much. And to see whether the end result is like. Yeah. After a while, you get used to it, you just kind of leave everything alone and it's kind of sort itself out. But in the beginning, yeah, it doesn't hurt to kind of play around a little bit. See what works for yourself, what doesn't. Like you said, some people meditate better in the morning, other in the evening, switch around, walking meditation as well. Yeah, you find yourself sleeping, yeah, Just a bit of walking meditation also helps to kind of brighten the mind, bring up a bit of energy. But I also mentioned you can also do standing meditation as well. Yeah. So just stand in place and just, you know, you'll find that just a change in posture sometimes, you know, can make all the difference in terms of bringing up energy and focus to the mind. How long should you try to meditate before you give up if you're not focused or restless? It depends. Sometimes, depends on what you try. I just watch. If you're feeling sleepy, just watch. You see me nod back and forth. Yeah, just watch the sloth and torpor. Generally, it goes away by itself. So you kind of, you know, starting to do, be more of a watcher. And then these things will sort themselves out. Otherwise, then you find if it, you know, maybe a half an hour or something, it's not working. Yeah, then change posture and do something else. Or maybe it depends, or 15 minutes. It varies on, you know, kind of how much time you have. You know, like a long retreat, you have more time to play around with it. Shorter, then, you know, you can, you know, kind of manage it shorter periods. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Questions or comments? Okay, moving along. Dear Ajahn, question one. Can you please share a meditation war story with us? It would help to motivate me to sit through pain and discomfort. Okay, fictional example. I once sat in a tree for 6 weeks without food or water. Not quite. Maybe 6 minutes. But the problem, if I share war stories, then people might kind of feel inspired to emulate that. It might not, you know, and we all come from very different kind of situations. But, yeah, you know how it is when you're young. And I was a novice, yeah, full of inspirations and different things. And one of the practices I used to do was true. You know, we had this, do a lot of reading from one of the meditation master in Thailand. And his thing was dukkha vedana, which is investigating painful sensations. So you sit, you don't move, and it depends. And this is a big caution, okay? Not everybody would, not to try it at home, only at, in the presence of professionals. Do not sue the BSWA if something goes wrong. But yeah, if you have a fairly normal knee and fairly in good physical condition, generally, you can sit for about 4 hours without doing permanent damage. Anyway, that's how I was told. So I was young, I was game. So I did that for like a month or 2 months. And we had this like long retreat where we go into the jungle in Thailand, and it was all very inspiring. Lots of guys, you know, about 15 guys, all very kind of young, and then we had this teacher. He's very, very kind of gung-ho. You read all these kind of very, you know, inspiring stories where all this Ajahn would sit for hours and hours and hours. And we were told that was the shortcut to Nirvana. So we all want to be there. We want to get going. So I did. I sat, and you sat without moving for 4 hours each at a go. Because and then you'll see all the pain arising, and it's quite painful. And you would not imagine how much pain can come up in the body. When you don't move, and it was it was not unbeneficial. I thought it does help you to kind of relate to the pain. You have a lot of compassion for people, like, you know, I can break my posture after 4 or 5 hours and the pain will be gone, but, you know, some people have, you know, kind of chronic pain, disease, cancer, and they can break the posture. Yeah, so you really can feel, you know, for people who are suffering, that how much pain this body can rack up in each and every one of us. But it was, like I said, more inspiration than wisdom, because it was more like sheer, you know, kind of willpower. Occasionally there would be peaceful. What you do it, and it's kind of a tricky practice that it's silly enough for everybody. It's you push the mind so much because there's so much suffering that occasionally it lets go because there's so much pain that it goes into this samadhi. But it's not for everybody, and you have to have a lot of faith in the process. Because what it does, and you have to be very careful, is that every time you sit, so much pain come up, the mind will associate the sitting with the pain, and you're not going to want to do it. Yes, after a while I stopped doing it because, you know, every time you sit, it's like, oh, well, maybe I'll do something else. No, go have a cup of tea instead of sitting. Maybe I go for a walk instead of sitting meditation, because the mind knows there's going to be so much pain coming up that it generally doesn't want to do it. But also, you learn a lot, though, that you sit, the more mindfulness you have, just really digging into the practice, looking at the pain, and not whinging about it. It's just sensation. So occasionally there were, you know, moments of insight in that way. When there were strong mindfulness, the pain is not painful, if that makes sense. It's just a sensation. And if occasionally, very occasionally, it disappears on its own. So you're like, oh, there you go. Yeah. And it's something that you don't, you know, get to experience unless you sit through. But then again, you know, it's kind of a specialized practice that I don't recommend for most people, because there's so much pain that, you know, you've got enough pain in your life and stress already. You don't need to go to, you know, sit in meditation and add more of that. Yeah. So it's only for the person who's kind of get lots of time to meditate, but you have not so much time. Go for the more gentle approach and relax in the body first, and the mind will calm down as well on its own. Yeah. So the other one is, you know, just too much association with the pain that will have the opposite effect. Instead of, you know, kind of getting you to meditate more and experience the benefit of meditation, it will lead you to the other way because there's so much pain involved. Yeah. But again, like I said, and that's why I keep saying pain is pain. Yeah, it's just pain. You won't die from it. If you are in reasonably good health, then I do, and I always check. After I sit, I get up and I kind of massage the knee, walk around, and it's gone. So you know that a lot of the pain is like mentally generated somehow. Because, you know, if it's so painful, if I get up, the pain should stay, but it's not. It's completely gone after 5 minutes. So that's why I know that it's kind of working through it slowly. And many people, though, unfortunately, they get up and then you still have pain after half an hour, then you know that you shouldn't do that again. Because obviously you're doing something more permanent damage to your knees and your tendons. Yeah, so approach that practice very carefully. And like I said, I worked my way up. It's not like I sat for 4 hours the first time. Just, you know, 2 hours, 2.5, 3 hours, slowly. Just pushing gently. Yeah. But like I said, it's more of a war story than something that's practical that I encourage, you know, people to try. Okay. Questions or comments? Question number 2. In the interest of democracy, can we vote on whether to chant in Pali or in English in the mornings? This is Theravada. It's not a democracy. In the morning, but that's the reason, because we, in the interest of appealing to different sectors of our meditator, that's why we alternate. In the morning we chant in English, evening in Pali most of the time. Yeah. And I think because there are not so many traditional Buddhists, it's nice to chant in English because people can understand. Yeah, for myself, I find it's more important to understand the meaning than, you know, kind of a Pali thing. Yeah. Yeah. Questions, comments, more? Push for a vote? Referendum? Yes?
Just curious, this is changing, is it? What is the beneficialness, chanting? You know, like, I mean, I don't understand the thing that you're saying, so when you chant in that language anyway, and so I'm just wondering, I don't know, it all feels nice and sounds good, but I'm just wondering what the actual beneficialness is of it.
It's supposed to help to focus the mind, like, you know, bring thinking about the Buddha, the enlightened one, the compassionate one, purity, peace. The Dhamma is something truth, brings benefit. Yeah, so it helps to settle the mind first, and it helps to inspire the mind. So that's the reason why, yeah, probably in English it's better, because it points you that way. You know, Dhamma, you know, leads to liberation, to be experienced by the wise, something that's peaceful and sublime. Yeah, so that's the reason for the chant. And especially the Metta Sutta, the Sutta on loving kindness. You know, like a mother to her only child, you know, protect them, you know, this kind of protectiveness, caring. And, you know, you don't harm beings, you know, big, short, or small, long, thin, and heavy, or whatever. Yeah. So this kind of setting up the mind to, you know, make it more soft, pliable, gentle, embracing. Yeah. So that's the reason for the chant. It's kind of bringing up nice qualities. And then when we sit, yeah, it stays with us. Yeah, so that's kind of that's the chant, and also brings up energy. You know, the act of chanting itself brings up energy, especially in the morning when you're kind of a bit sleepy or whatever. Yeah. And also your only excuse to talk, right, for the whole day is that chanting. Okay. Yeah. Right, sure. The benefit in Pali is that if you go to different monasteries, then that's chant all the time. So that's why in the morning you see I'm looking at the book, because some of the English translation is different from the one we have. Yeah. So that's the why English is rough, you know, kind of rough translations. It's never exactly the same. Yeah. And then the benefit of Pali is that anywhere you go in a Theravada country or a Theravada monastery, same chant, same word. But even so, they chant it differently, different intonation, different kind of pronunciation as well. Yeah, but the general thing is pretty much similar. Yeah. Any other questions or comments? Oh, the question was, what's the benefit of chanting? And that's, we just answered that. Okay, final question. Dear John, what role do you see choiceless awareness or open awareness as a meditation practice? Thank you. That is also very useful in certain instances. Sometimes, you know, when the mind is a bit restless, it doesn't want to settle into the breath, or there's a lot of thinking in the mind, then just, you know, instead of kind of trying to focus it, using too much force onto the object, just allow the mind to go where it want to go, and you're just kind of paying attention to that. So yeah, choiceless awareness, just see what comes into your sphere of awareness, and just being with that. So that also is helpful in that case. And the thing is, if you're trying to cultivate samadhi, which is one-pointedness, if it flits around to different objects all the time, then it never settles down. So this, it never becomes very deep. So the peace will be, you know, there will be some sort of peace, but it's not as deep as you start to narrow down the awareness to a single object. Yeah. But certainly it's a good starting point. Just opening up the awareness, see what, you know, sounds around, the thoughts, feelings of the body, anything that is in the present moment. Even if you're thinking, just keep framing that in the present moment. I'm thinking this thought in the present moment. And that's fine. It will start to help slow down the thinking. Yes, and it brings up a certain amount of awareness, mindfulness. And when that's, I find, anyway, when your mindfulness becomes more strong, the mind naturally just kind of narrows it down to certain things anyway. For myself, it's just the breathing. I'm, you know, watching my breath for so long that as soon as the body comes down, the breathing process comes up. Just the moving of the chest and the air, the nose, yeah, different thing comes up. Right away. Yeah. So that's there is a, and you can cultivate this choiceless awareness from time to time. Yeah, because sometimes it's kind of, you know, it gets a bit boring just focusing on the breath all the time on one thing. Just open it up and see what's around you. Different things that come into your consciousness, especially if you're walking. It's very nice walking, just, you know, aware the birds, you know, the smell of the different kind of gum trees. The feeling of the ground on your feet, feeling the heat on your head, anything, the fly crawling in your face, all sorts of good things when you're walking around. So just open them, allow that to come in. Sometimes it's also refreshing, like I said, it brings some kind of freshness to the mind, as an alternative to just kind of narrow down the focus all the time. Any additional comments or questions?
In this choice of the wind,
yeah.
Does it feel like kind of an anchor? Like you do notice whatever is going on, but you always go back to one object, not trying to focus on it.
Mm.
Is there something like an anchor? Or is it just whatever arises and you never go back to steps or breathing or anything?
And the question is, I remember finally, the last question I remember. The question is, in choiceless awareness, do we allow the mind to go to all over to different objects, or is there an anchor that we move back to over and over again? I'm guessing at this moment, because I don't practice very much, but the way I practice choiceless awareness is to use the body as an anchor. So I can allow the mind to go around and to experience different things. It go back to the body and just kind of different sensation. But I think what people say when they say choiceless awareness is that, no, they just keep it open. As long as it's happening, anything, as far as I know, in the present moment. So anything, just being aware, whatever. And it's not one thing that you're kind of focusing on. Yeah. If there ever comes to mind, just know, okay, yeah. It comes. Yeah. That's, I think I'm guessing. Feel free to comment or add if there is still a question.
I think it's more like the Burmese method of when you say choiceless awareness,
yeah.
But as she says, there's a primary anchor where you concentrate, your breathing is on the navel.
Okay.
But then if you hear a bird,
that's right.
You hear, you say, it's a noise or hearing.
Right.
The fact, one of your senses, hearing,
yeah.
But you come back.
To the navel again.
Yes, the navel.
Oh, okay, okay, there you go. Yeah, so it is, that there is an anchor to move back in.
Because of
Mahati,
right?
That's right.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So, okay.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, so it is using the body as an anchor and just moving out and then moving back in again with the navel. Questions, comments then?
Maybe you said something to the previous question.
Okay, sure.
Pali. I like listening in Pali,
uh-huh.
But I remember just now, I think Buddha said to his monks that when they go out,
yeah.
Go and teach in the local language.
That's right.
Local language. So therefore, I think there are a lot of, people who haven't even heard any Pali words. So I think what you are doing is perfect, mm-hmm. Because local language is English.
That's right.
We can understand both Pali and English.
Right, right.
So it is better that you chant in English. But okay. I like in Pali,
okay.
Which we are used to. But
yeah. Okay. We have a quick vote. Okay. In Pali? Now, in the moment, to the one or the other, because some people made the statement that in Pali, they don't really understand what's happening. And they don't. Not everybody shows up to both sessions, so that's why. So you only showed up to the evening session, you only get the Pali bit.
Well, in that case, let's start you in the Karaniya with the Sutta.
I really enjoyed it. It's in both.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah.
Okay. Sure. Yeah, it's Pali, is some of you may not know, it's like similar to Latin. It's only used in books and it's not a spoken language anymore. Yeah. But it's still, it's not exactly the language of the Buddha, but very closely. Like, it's developed around the same area within a few years after he passed away. It's a very, very close dialect of what the Buddha used. Yeah.
It's also, you've got the translation anyway.
That's right. So those who are very curious, you can always pick up the book and look at the translation on the other side and see what they point to. And I encourage that because it's meant to, you know, to bring up a sense of kind of mental states, inspirations and brightness and things that we're aiming for. You know, whatever you kind of chant, think about, focus on, those are the qualities that grow in your practice, in your mind over time. Yeah, so even if we are chanting Pali, trying to see where the word is pointing to. Yeah. Okay, we'll just leave it be.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. Wait. Yes, Sue? Yeah, I let you know. Yeah, it's on page 8, and then it's on the even pages.
It's really helpful.
I will remember that. Try to remember that this morning. Yeah, sure. Yeah. I was thinking, oh, third day, people are very mindful. They probably remember what page, but it's probably not. Probably not. Cause if you're missing a few sessions or something, cause, yeah, that's fine. I will name the pages, the beginning of each chanting. Any other questions or comments? So I won't stretch the talk any longer because you guys are all very sleepy. I've saved the talk for tomorrow morning, okay? Okay, great. Thank you for all your questions or comments. And you can continue sitting or have a rest.